It's the takeaway for Wednesday, August 14th, 2019. I'm Tanzina Vega. Survivors of child sexual abuse in New York who missed the statute of limitations are getting another chance at justice, and many are speaking out.
They wanted their story to be broadcast, to maybe reach out to somebody who didn't know about this yet or who might think that their chance at justice has come and gone and they have to sit with their lot in life forever.
It's called a look-back window, and we'll ask what the coming lawsuits will look like in New York and how they've played out in other states. Also on the show, Puerto Rico's former governor signed millions of dollars in questionable government contracts during his last week in office.
What we saw over the last week of his governorship was no different from what he had done previously during his governorship.
Plus, a fatal nuclear explosion in Russia is bringing up questions about the country's weapons program. And one of the biggest surprise medical costs is the ambulance ride, an industry that has faced less regulation than other sectors of healthcare.
So even a relatively low unexpected bill to some Americans is a very, very large one to others.
Let's start with New York's new look-back window on child sexual abuse cases. And we want to let you know that there is a brief graphic description of sexual abuse coming up. Starting today, New York State is expanding the statute of limitations for survivors of child sexual abuse. It's part of the Child Victims Act passed by the state legislature back in January, which allows survivors much more time to file legal action against their abusers and the institutions that may have been involved. And that includes the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church. Today also kicks off a year-long so-called look-back window for anyone who wants to file a lawsuit regardless of when the abuse took place. People like a 74-year-old Queens resident who was abused by a priest during a summer camp in the early 1950s.
He would call you in once in a while and he'd sit you on his lap and he would ask you, how do you like the camp, how's things going, like that, you know. And then he would fondle your, you know, put his hand down there and fondle your genitals and stuff like that. And I was a kid, you know. I wasn't smart enough to comprehend what he was doing.
We're calling this survivor John Doe at his request to protect his privacy. And now that the look-back window is opening, he says he plans to sue the Brooklyn Diocese where the priest worked.
I don't think they should get away with it. I don't think anybody that does something wrong should get away with it, no. I don't care if they've doubted me or not. It happened, and I know it happened, and that's it.
John spoke with reporter Mara Silvers, who's been covering New York's Child Victims Act for WNYC, and she joins us now. Mara, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So what does the Child Victims Act do?
So it does two things, really. It expands the statute of limitations for criminal and civil cases going forward, but then it also turns around and says, okay, so for all of the people who were not able to bring civil cases for decades because of the previous statute of limitations, we're going to give those people 1 year to file those cases in New York courts. Previously, many victims in the state, most victims in the state, had to file civil or criminal cases before they turned 23. Now, going forward, victims will have until their 55th birthday to bring civil claims. So the civil lawsuits give individuals a chance not only to sue the person who they say abused them, but in cases where that person might have passed away or might not be around anymore or eligible, the victims also have the chance to sue the institution that they say is responsible for allowing the abuse to take place. That opens up the Catholic Church, definitely, the Boy Scouts, but also other institutions that we might not be as familiar with.
And we know advocates had been pushing for this law in New York State for at least a decade. It finally passed this year. What made that change?
So the Child Victims Act had been proposed and brought up in the legislature for years and years and years. And before this past session, Republicans had been in control of the state Senate for a long time. So what we would see is almost every year, the Child Victims Act would get proposed, it would pass through the assembly, and then it would die in the Senate. It would die in committee. And as of last election cycle, the Democrats took over the Senate and now control both houses in the state legislature. And that was one of the first things that they had on their to-do list, was to pass the Child Victims Act. So It really was a signal of a sea change of priorities for legislators in the state.
Were there other bodies involved? Was the Catholic Church involved in perhaps trying to stop this legislation from being passed?
Definitely. The Catholic Church was one of the organizations that was lobbying against this legislation for a long time. They said especially that the look-back window would be deeply unfair to the Catholic Church and that it would bring up a lot of cases that are based on faulty evidence and faded memories, and that it would be a tidal wave that the church couldn't handle. Now, it's important to say that the Catholic Church did change its position this year. I think they may have reassessed their situation. They may have looked at the political moment that we're in, and they decided not to fight it.
You mentioned public schools, the Boy Scouts, the Catholic Church. What other types of groups could see lawsuits as a result of this law?
So the advocates and the lawyers who I've talked to have said, really, when we think about child sex abuse, it is, one person called it an equal opportunity crime. It can happen to anyone and it can happen anywhere. I think it's important to say that this is about private families and personal life as well. So possibly lawsuits against parents and family members and close friends of the family. We really don't know the extent to which these cases are going to affect all realms of life in New York.
So let's talk a little bit about what this is going to look like. The courts are expecting to see hundreds, perhaps thousands of lawsuits filed in the coming weeks. Are the courts prepared to handle this rush of cases?
They say that they are. We'll have to wait and see exactly how this unfolds. But the Office of Court Administration in New York told me that they have picked 45 judges across the state to be specifically handling these cases. They also say that over the summer, they spent some time with judges during their training sessions to explain exactly what this law does, the nuances of it, and how to handle cases that are so sensitive with adult survivors of child sex abuse. We know that the courts are trying. They're going to try to get these cases resolved as quickly as possible, mediate when that's available. But from looking at other states, we know that there are sometimes cases that take years to resolve themselves long after the look-back window actually closes. So that's a possibility in New York as well.
How are institutions like the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts and beyond preparing themselves for the lawsuits?
One big sign that we've seen from the New York Archdiocese and Rockefeller University Hospital in Manhattan is that those institutions have sued their insurers proactively to ensure in some way that they will provide coverage for these cases. We know that that's a sign that the church in this situation and Rockefeller Hospital are looking to see what kinds of options they have to get more resources to help settle these cases.
Mara, in your reporting, you've spoken to victims of child sexual abuse. What are they looking for as this new law takes effect and the look back window opens?
It's a complete range across the emotional and political spectrum in some ways. I think I was surprised and interested to not really hear a lot of redundancy in terms of what people were looking for. Everyone had a little bit of a different story. Some things that I heard from the people who I spoke to was that they wanted to connect with other survivors. They were talking to me as a journalist only because they wanted their story to be broadcast, to maybe reach out to somebody who didn't know about this yet or who might think that their chance at justice has come and gone and they have to sit with their lot in life forever. Definitely an emotional decision for a lot of people. And I think it's important to say that not everyone who is a survivor might want to bring a case in this situation. It might not be justice for everyone, but it is for a lot of people.
Mara Silvers is a reporter at WNYC. Mara, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
New York is not the first state to open a so-called look-back window for survivors of child sexual abuse. California, Minnesota, Michigan, and others have all made similar moves. For a national conversation around look-back windows and how they've been handled by survivors and how they've impacted the institutions who found themselves targets of the lawsuits, we have Tom Scheck, reporter for American Public Media's Investigative Reporting and Radio Documentaries Project, APM Reports. Tom, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hey there.
So remind us, how many states have opened look-back windows for survivors of child sexual abuse?
Well, I don't have the exact number on that, but I can tell you there have been more than 10 bankruptcies across the country from dioceses and archdioceses where this has occurred. And mostly that's resulted because a look-back window in a state has been opened or because litigation occurred. There's a lot of lawsuits that are filed, and then what happens is the diocese or archdiocese declares bankruptcy because they are facing a financial strain there. That is one of the keys that happens.
Now, you've covered Minnesota's look-back window in 2013 and the years of lawsuits and settlements that followed. What makes Minnesota unique in this case?
What happens here is that it's almost every archdiocese and diocese follows a certain playbook. And so in Minnesota, the window was open for 3 years, not 1 year like in New York. And so what occurred was that what you'll see is that it'll be a lot of plaintiff's attorneys that start to discuss their services, and they start to say, have you been a victim of sexual abuse, whether it's the Boy Scouts, whether it's the archdiocese. And what happens typically after that is, in the case of the Twin Cities parishes, is that the archdiocese declares bankruptcy. And in 2015, that's what happened in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And what that does is two things. One is it rolls all of the litigants, all of the plaintiffs, into one case. They become, frankly, creditors. That all gets rolled into one thing. And then the other thing it also does, which is a legal strategy, is it freezes litigation. And so that helps the cardinal, the archbishop, the priests, and it prevents them from going and testifying in each of these cases. And that prevents or saves them from the embarrassment of having to explain how they handled or mismanaged cases involving sexual abuse.
Do we know how many lawsuits ended up being filed by the time the look-back window was closed? As you said, the look-back window was open in Minnesota for 3 years as opposed to just one.
Yeah, I can tell you what it looks like in the Twin Cities Archdiocese. There was 450 survivors of clergy abuse who were represented in that bankruptcy settlement. But what you'll see is all of those litigants will then come in, they'll be a part of the bankruptcy, and then they'll end up settling. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, that was the largest bankruptcy settlement that occurred. It was about a year or two ago. That was a $210 million settlement. And then most of the funds actually came from insurance, $170 million came from insurance, and then $40 million had to come from the archdiocese itself and from parishes.
Were you able to speak with any of the survivors of child sexual abuse? And if so, what was their feeling on the opening of this look-back window and the ultimate outcome here?
Well, in many cases, they wanted justice, and that wasn't always just financial. They wanted an apology from the church. They wanted to be heard almost. That was one of the bigger things that was almost surprising to us, is that it wasn't always about the money. It was holding these individuals accountable for things that happened many, many years ago. And one of the things that we've learned through this is that when these adults who are now, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when they're 10, 11, 12, 13, they don't really understand what's occurring. And sometimes that takes them a decade or even more to process. But when they get older, they go through therapy, they realize that this was not their fault. What they do is what they want to do is then hold the institution accountable. And this gives them that ability to do so.
What do you suspect is driving this charge lately? There have been almost 20 states that have recently expanded their own statutes of limitations here. We know that 9 states have opened some kind of look-back window for survivors of child sexual abuse. What do you expect is driving these states to do that?
I think a lot of it has to do with public pressure. I mean, you've seen over the last 15, 20 years, you know, the instances which occurred in Boston, in Minneapolis, in Pennsylvania, where this exposure to this abuse has occurred. And what that has done is it has given victims and, frankly, victims' attorneys the ability to start to encourage public policy leaders to say, you know what, let's go back and open up this window. What will occur is that you're going to see probably almost a year from now, you'll see a lot of victims' attorneys advertising like crazy to say, you know, this is your chance to file suit. And what that does is that gives the insurance companies and the institutions that have had to deal with this the ability to then almost, you know, close that window, and they hope permanently. But for in other instances, it gives the ability for the victims to then come forward.
Tom Scheck is a correspondent for American Public Media's APM Reports. Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
The Russian government is facing scrutiny after releasing conflicting information about a nuclear explosion in the northern part of the country that killed at least 7 people on an offshore rig last Thursday. Russian officials initially downplayed the scale of the incident, and they did not confirm that the explosion involved a nuclear reactor until Sunday. United States intelligence officials told our next guest that they believe the explosion may have involved a nuclear-propelled missile, which raises new questions about ongoing tensions between the U.S. and Russia. The Kremlin refused to confirm this, but a spokesman said, quote, accidents happen. David Sanger is a national security correspondent for The New York Times, and he's been following all of the latest developments closely. David, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Tanzina.
So explain to us the timeline here. I mean, the Russians first reported one thing and they started to change that story. What was that about?
Well, you know, on Thursday when this all happened, their initial report was that there had been some kind of accident involving a liquid-fueled rocket. This was near a missile testing center that they have up on the White Sea. That's a part of northern Russia, sort of closest to Finland. And that didn't seem to jibe with some information that showed up on a website for one of the nearest cities, which indicated a spike in radiation, a brief one, on Thursday afternoon. And that raised the question, well, liquid-fueled rockets don't create radiation. What was possibly going on here? And as things unfolded over the next few days, it turned out that there weren't just two people missing. It looks like there were up to seven dead and maybe more. Then the Russians changed their story and said that the problem had been with an isotope power supply for a liquid-fueled rocket. So isotope was the first acknowledgement that something radiological was going on here. And, of course, the more we pieced together, the more it ended up looking like they were testing a new missile that Vladimir Putin had announced last year, a missile that was called is nuclear powered, or at least partly nuclear powered, and which has been called Skyfall by NATO.
And we'll get into a little bit more about the specifics of that missile. I'm wondering, what's the difference between what the Russians were claiming and what the U.S. is claiming? And does the United States have anything to back up its claim that this may have been that nuclear-propelled missile that exploded?
Well, it's interesting. American intelligence officials have said nothing in public. I've had some background conversations with some intelligence officials. But shortly after we published our story saying that U.S. intelligence had identified this as the Skyfall missile, it goes by a different name by the Russians, President Trump tweeted out on Monday evening that, in fact, he had been receiving intelligence about the accident involving the Skyfall missile and that the U.S. was learning a lot about it and that we had similar technology and that ours worked. Is, depending on what he meant by that, not entirely correct.
David, this explosion happened on an offshore rig, but tell us again, what was the nuclear radiation level impact both on land and in the sea?
Well, on land, it seems fairly modest. There was an increase off the background level that was initially described as 2 times normal, and then later described as 16 times normal. Even at 16 times, it would not be a whole lot worse than what you would get in other, you know, normal events, flying airplanes, getting an X-ray, so forth and so on. We don't know what it is at sea. And one of the interesting theories about this, Cincinnati, is that the missile was launched, and of course, the way this missile works, it did not have a nuclear warhead on the front. That would only be, you know, obviously in times of conflict, but it was powered by a nuclear reactor. And if that went bad, it looks like the missile went right into the sea. It didn't operate the way it was supposed to. And there is some indication that the accident happened when they recovered it and brought it back up above, back onto this platform. And by the account of the institute where 5 of the scientists were employed, it then exploded in some way, killed all of those who were working on it on the platform. And that suggests that in some way the sea may have actually been cooling this nuclear reactor and that when they brought it up, it spun out of control.
David, is this an indication that there's an increase here for a potential danger with the nuclear arms race between the United States and Russia?
Well, there are two separate issues here. One way to interpret this is that the Russians are trying some new experimental means that President Putin has announced to enable their missiles to go anywhere on Earth. And that would be the advantage of having a nuclear reactor at the back of a missile. In other words, that it could fly almost indefinitely. The United States tried this in the late 50s and early 60s in something called Project Pluto, and they gave it up by 1964. They couldn't make it work, and it was spewing radiation out the exhaust. So that's the sort of short-term view, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Russians discover, as the Americans did, that this technology doesn't work. But the bigger picture is just what you suggest, that both the U.S. and Russia, and of course China, are developing new kinds of missiles that don't fit into existing arms treaties, aren't covered by existing arms treaties, that are made to evade missile defenses. And the suggestion of this entire incident is that the Russians probably won't be deterred, that they will double down in finding new ways, because Putin views this as a way of restoring the grand power of a Soviet Union whose demise he's always regretted.
We've mentioned that that President Trump has tweeted about this, saying that the United States has similar more advanced technology. President Putin, so far as we know, has not made any official statements on this. What does this do to the Trump-Putin relationship, which has been quite a spectacle under the Trump administration so far?
It certainly has. And one way to interpret what's going on is that both sides are building up capabilities in order to be able to trade them away in some grander arms negotiation. And certainly President Trump has said he wants new arms agreements that cover every type of arm and also includes China, which all of the old ones involving the United States and the Soviet Union and then later on with Russia did not. But so far, there's been no motion in that direction. And the Chinese clearly are not interested. They keep a smaller number of weapons, but have invested heavily in high technology in those weapons.
Well, we'll have to watch and see. David Sanger is the national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
After weeks of political turmoil in Puerto Rico, Wanda Vasquez was sworn in as the island's governor. And one of her first moves has been to cancel a contract to rebuild the island's power grid, which was destroyed after Hurricane Maria in 2017. In fact, Vasquez, who's under intense scrutiny, has vowed to evaluate all of the contracts signed by Governor Ricardo Rosselló, who, in the last 2 weeks of his failed governorship, Rosselló is said to have signed more than 200 contracts totaling around $80 million. In the weeks preceding Rosselló's resignation, the FBI arrested two top officials from his administration over alleged mishandling of government contracts. So to help us break all of this down, we're joined by Nicole Acevedo, reporter with NBC News Digital. Nicole, thanks for being with us again.
Thank you, Tansina.
So my goodness, this story just doesn't stop.
Nope.
So let's talk about these contracts that Rosselló was signing and what the scope of them were. I mean, how transparent has the Puerto Rican government been in granting contracts to companies?
I mean, that is the biggest contradiction of the legacy of the Rosselló administration. He kept touting transparency and, we saw him signing all these contracts behind closed doors, and he didn't even disclose all of them. So people that maybe groups in the island that are kind of work as watchdogs in the government in Puerto Rico were kind of noticing that even some of the contracts that he signed, he didn't make a press release or any public announcement. What we saw over the last week of his governorship was no different from what he had done previously during his governorship. And I mean, Wanda Vasquez, I think, came into becoming the governor of Puerto Rico with a lot of things against her, not only because she was unelected, but she was a very divisive figure in the island. And a lot of the allegations that came to light was that she was aware that certain, for example, Hurricane Maria aid was being mishandled and she didn't investigate. So people were very skeptical about her. So I think that with this first moves, I think she's trying to say, hey, I know I technically wasn't interested in this position, but I took on my constitutional mandate and I'm willing to make it work.
Do we have any sense of what kinds of contracts Rosselló signed before he left office, and really how big of a task does Wanda Vasquez have now in reviewing all these contracts?
It's very big. I mean, even the Federal Oversight Board that oversees all of Puerto Rico finances doesn't even have an idea of all these contracts. So pretty recently they put out a statement saying, hey, we saw over many news stories saying that all these contracts were granted and they're not publicly available yet. Can we get a copy of those? Because the Federal Oversight Board has certain parameters in place to oversee these things, right? To help the government of Puerto Rico balance its budget and make sure that they're not spending more than they should. And the power company contract was no different. I mean, we're talking about nearly $500,000 for 1 month to reconstruct a power grid that we all know was completely destroyed after Hurricane Maria. But also, that power grid is in the process of being privatized. So that adds another element that, you know, people are concerned about where this money is going to.
So this has roots in the Rosselló administration. As you mentioned at the very beginning, Rosselló was very criticized heavily for his granting of contracts, and not just criticized, but his administration saw the FBI arrested folks in his administration for mishandling of contracts. Let's remind our listeners what happened with former Education Secretary Julia Kelleher and former Director of the Health Insurance Administration, Angela Avila Marrero.
I mean, in the case very specifically of the Education Department, when Kelleher was the Secretary of Education, what came out of that legal action that got her arrested was that she was essentially, people that were close to her in her day-to-day work were saying, hey, you know, I have a friend that works at this company and they would like a contract with your Department of Education. And that's a problem because these contracts are supposed to go through a competitive process. So those allegations came out in the Department of Education and similar ones in with Angie Avila, who was the head of ACES, which basically handles a lot of Medicaid, Medicare funds. So, you know, this is a practice that unfortunately goes back beyond the Rosselló administration. But I think the reason why people reacted the way they reacted, we saw it in the protest and in the ouster of Rosselló, is because this is a different time in the history of Puerto Rico. You don't only have the crisis of the hurricane, but that compounded with the crisis of more than a decade-long recession, financial crisis. And people want to see hope. They want to see things get better. And I think they're demanding more from their leaders for that reason.
Nicole, at the end of the day, Puerto Rico's power grid is still not functioning at
yes.
full capacity. There's lots of work that needs to be done on the island. Is Vasquez doing this just for the optics of saying, look, we're going to be transparent? Is she doing it just to appease her critics? Or is this serious? And if so, is that going to hold up some of the progress that has to happen in Puerto Rico, especially in terms of infrastructure and education?
I mean, I think that is still yet to see. For now, at least, you know, this is just one thing that she's doing that people that are already critics of her are like, oh, yeah, she's just trying to seem like she cares. And all of a sudden, she's the governor that's going to save everything. But other people are just like, you know what? I'm willing to give Wanda Vasquez the benefit of the doubt. And so far, she hasn't disappointed. But I think that that should not mean that politicians in the island should say, okay, now everything is fine. People have calmed down. Because people, it's almost like their fuse has shortened with everything that has happened this summer. And the minute that something happens that sparks that fuse and brings that fire again, people, we're probably going to see a lot of the pushback and maybe the protest that we even saw this summer. So for now, maybe it's optics, but I think there is a good chance that she knows that she needs to keep this up.
Nicole Acevedo is a reporter with NBC News Digital. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thank you.
People who call an ambulance in an emergency can often be met with more stress than the visit itself, a surprise bill for the cost of the ride. Ambulances are one of the biggest providers of out-of-network services, and out-of-network billing for healthcare services has become more frequent and much more costly. That's according to a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And while Congress, the president, and the 2020 Democratic candidates have all spoken about the need to rein in healthcare costs, ambulance services have not been part of that conversation. To avoid the possibility of getting hit with a massive bill after the fact, some people are opting to call someone else for help getting to the ER.
My name's Maggie, and I'm from Long Valley, New Jersey. I needed to use an Uber driver because I had a kidney stone and I couldn't drive myself. I knew it wasn't bad enough to incur the cost of an ambulance. The Uber driver was freaked out, but they were super helpful and they got me to the hospital quickly. Tipping the Uber driver was a lot easier than dealing with the insurance involved with taking an ambulance ride.
This is Susan Eddy calling from San Francisco. I had severe food poisoning and massive dehydration and dragged myself into a lift instead of asking a friend since it was really late at night. I didn't even consider calling an expensive ambulance. The Lyft driver was more concerned about himself getting sick than my well-being, which isn't really surprising.
Many of you told us that sometimes it seems like ride-hailing apps are a cheaper way to go. But that puts drivers for companies like Uber and Lyft in a really difficult position, and we'll have more on that in a bit. But first, I have two people to talk to me about why ambulances cost so much and how that impacts emergency health care. David Slesky is a professor of economics at the University of Kansas. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Lauren Adler is an associate director at USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
So I got to be honest with you. When I first heard about this story, I was pretty horrified, but I'm generally horrified by the state of our healthcare system in the United States. David, why are so many people getting surprise medical bills from ambulances?
One is there's not a lot of options between an ambulance and driving your own car. Another is that, you know, you don't want to get this wrong when you're really, really sick. And another is a lot of towns only have one ambulance company, and that ambulance company then gets to set the rules. Here in Lawrence, Kansas, we had an article in our local paper a few years ago that we only have one ambulance company, and they don't contract. They're not a network with any of our private insurances, only with Medicare and with Medicaid. And also, in an emergency situation, consumers can't shop around. They can't find an in-network provider because every minute counts, and that makes them very vulnerable to this kind of exploitation.
So how does the system work from when I call 911 to what ambulance I get? Do I have a choice when I call 911, or 911 is just going to dispatch whatever ambulance is available?
I think it depends on the city and depends on the situation. Individuals can, in some places, call private ambulances directly. But in general, you call 911, they're going to, at an abundance of caution, send you an ambulance. You know, I'd love to think of a world with video calls 911 and video triage, and they can get the feed from your Apple Watch to get your pulse and monitor your heart. But we're just not there yet, unfortunately.
Yeah, we're absolutely not there. And in fact, one of the surprising things about this is not just the cost, but how we get to this cost. Lauren, how many ambulance companies are, dare I use the phrase, out of network?
I think that term out of network for an ambulance is almost sounds like an oxymoron to people. But obviously, sadly, that's not the case. So we have, there was actually a study published yesterday in JAMA that showed that 86% of all ground ambulance rides in this country are actually delivered out of network, meaning that that ambulance provider had not contracted with your insurance company. And we're only talking about people who have insurance in this situation, and private insurance, so not Medicare. Obviously, that is a pretty staggering number. So Lawrence, Kansas is not alone here where the ambulances are not taking insurance companies. And right, the fundamental market failure here is just there's typically one ambulance provider. The patient has no choice over which ambulance company is going to pick them up. And therefore, in an unregulated market, the ambulance company can basically demand whatever price they want. And often the insurance company is not going to be willing to pay full freight on that. Maybe they'll pay something more like what Medicare pays. And then the patient is often left paying the balance In the study yesterday, it seemed like on average, people were responsible for something like $250 when they were taken by an ambulance, which is obviously a pretty frustrating toll on top of needing the ambulance to begin with.
And why aren't more ambulance companies in network? And I want to expand on that a little bit to ask you, don't most insurance companies cover some sort of emergency care? And if they do, why aren't ambulances part of that?
Sure. So you're definitely correct. So pretty much every insurance company covers ambulance services and definitely covers emergency services once you're at the hospital. They are typically, the insurer will almost always pay something towards that ambulance ride. So even if it was out of network, typically the insurer will pay some amount of money that they, you know, deem quote unquote reasonable to the ambulance provider. But then because the ambulance provider really has no incentive to take anything less than, you know, whatever number they can dream up, they will typically bill on top of what the insurer is paying. So even though the insurer is sort of covering these benefits, they have a lot of trouble actually coming to a contract agreement with the ambulance company here.
The survey Consumer Finance that the Federal Reserve puts together every couple of years looks at how many Americans can take an unexpected $400 expense. And the number who can't is generally around 40%. So even a relatively low unexpected bill to some Americans is a very, very large one to others.
And David, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit also about when people are calling an ambulance. This is probably one of the most vulnerable moments that most people have, right? They're afraid, there's something wrong. Has there been any attempt to regulate this industry? Because it almost feels predatory at this point to take advantage of folks who just aren't able to often make decisions for themselves.
Sure. I think most of the legislation on surprise bills in general healthcare, which 5 years ago nobody was talking about, generally ambulances are the hardest part of it to deal with. That it's easier to deal with this with hospitals and with physicians, especially when you have more players in the market and so less monopoly power. And I think that the legislation is just dealing with the lower hanging fruit first before moving on to the more difficult situations.
Lauren, why aren't ambulances part of any major healthcare cost savings proposal, at least that we're aware of?
So to start with, that is a very good question of which there is no satisfactory answer. I do think it's worth noting in this context that most localities, or at least a lot of localities or municipalities in this country, do regulate their ground ambulance providers. And in a lot of localities across the country, they are effectively taking bids from different ambulance companies to become sort of the sole provider in your area. And at that point, you know, when you call 911, you would get that provider, but the locality would have worked out some arrangement where either they're sort of paying out of tax dollars to the ambulance company, or often is the case, even when there is this deal with the locality, the ambulance can still balance bill each patient as they see them. That the amount they can balance bill is often regulated in this case, but it is still often in the, you know, $200 or more range. Or actually, I mean, in a different study, you saw average bill is at like $500. So it really depends. Part of this is that it really depends where you are across the country. It is often difficult for Congress to tackle this issue because it involves sort of sticking their foot in what has often been local regulation. And also, you're effectively would be banning the cities themselves from balance billing patients and therefore sort of reducing the tax base to some degree.
We should also make sure that we address, Lauren, the issue of the uninsured. What happens if you don't have insurance and you need an ambulance? What does the surprise bill look like then? Or do you even get picked up?
Sure. So they are required by law to pick you up, but you can, again, you're really back to the situation where it really depends on where you live. So there are going to be some areas of the country where you won't pay a dime because that's sort of covered by the local tax base. In sort of anecdotally talking to different areas, those seem to be the wealthier areas of the country, actually, that kind of deal with this out of their tax base. But in other areas of the country, you're going to be stuck with the same balance bills, where in this case it'll just be the full bill, where you might be even stuck with a little bit more money than someone who is insured, where at least their insurer sort of chipped in some money towards it. In this case, you're going to be paying the full freight, so maybe you're liable for $1,000 rather than $500. Obviously, not everyone is going to be able to pay that. So certainly you're going to sometimes lead to people having to declare bankruptcy or try to negotiate with the ambulance company to maybe give them a break, right? There's not that many good options here.
So there is a bit of a hopeful note on this, that the Affordable Care Act created a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation within the federal government entity that regulates Medicare and Medicaid. And they actually just recently put out a request for proposals on what they're calling ET3, which is Emergency Triage, Treat, and Transport. And this is a center that tries to figure out ways to reduce costs without hurting outcomes. And so there is right now at the federal level a conversation going on about what are our options here and how can we deal with this.
Now, David, there are folks who cannot take an ambulance or are afraid to take an ambulance because they don't have insurance or they don't have access to ambulances. And what we're noticing, and you've done research on this, is that people are taking car companies like Uber instead of ambulances to get to the hospital. Tell us a little bit about the research that you've done in that space.
Sure. So we looked at when UberX became available, which in about 100 cities happened at different times over a couple of years. So it gave us some nice natural variation. We matched this up with ambulance volume data and found that relative to where per capita ambulance volume had been before, the availability of Uber reduced ambulance volume by about 7%. And we've heard numerous anecdotes from patients, from Uber drivers, from emergency medicine providers, that this is something that is happening. Additionally, one of the most amazing stories we heard around this was the civil rights angle, that in many places, if you call 911, the police come as well. And in communities that don't necessarily want unneeded interactions with law enforcement, this was a way to get to the hospital without having that interaction.
We spoke to Aziz Ba in New York City. He's been an Uber driver for about 5 years. He's a member of the Independent Drivers Guild. And he told us that about once a month, he has to drive a passenger to the hospital. Let's take a listen to what his story is.
As soon as I parked, they rushed right in. One was just crying. The other one was screaming in pain. You know, he was like, you know, excuse me, driver, could we just go as fast as you can because we need to get to the hospital right away. While, of course, you know, one is screaming, you know, and the other one is crying. I am going through every yellow light and eventually I would go through pretty much every single red light all the way till I made it to the ER.
So, David, I want two questions here. First of all, what impact does that have on people who are trying to get to the hospital if they take an Uber versus an ambulance?
So the best case scenario is it saves them hundreds, if not thousands of dollars without impacting their health. I mean, I think one thing is, you know, there's situations where you're going to the ER and you know you're going to have to wait 6 hours, but because your driving leg has swelled up to the point that it's too painful for you to drive a car, that's the situation that I think we're talking about here. I don't think we're talking about the bleeding chest pain, every minute counts, you know, they're not even going to have you sit down in the waiting room situation. So there's a lot of heterogeneity here.
What about the impact on drivers, Uber drivers? And I want to play a little bit more of Aziz's answer here.
It affects my work. I can lose my job by doing stuff like that. And I just got to mention, like, you know, this is not unusual for riders to actually get the driver to break the law.
David, your thoughts on that?
Ideally, this would be a role for emergency medical services. You can imagine a regular car with lights and sirens that so they can legally run yellow and red lights, but isn't a full mobile emergency room the way that an ambulance is. So I think that there are options here that don't require us to rely on potentially untrained ride-sharing drivers who are exposed to legal liability or losing their job by doing this.
Lauren, any final thoughts on whether you see anything hopeful when it comes to the ambulance industry and the onus, the financial and economic onus that it places on everyday Americans?
I mean, I'd say the stories of Uber drivers sort of more break my heart to hear these sorts of people kind of being forced to use ride-sharing services. But it, I think, says something bad about our system that we have left that we have just have do not have adequate regulation of ambulances in this country, and we should have some sort of federal regulation that is making it so that people can call 911 and feel confident they're not going to get hit with a $1,000 bill. That there's something that shouldn't be happening here, and I think something that can be pretty easily fixed. You know, the hope for Congress to address something does not seem super hopeful this year, but I wouldn't rule it out. And this is one of those instances where the more public pressure there is, the more likely Congress is to act. Right. I think this is one of those instances where public pressure needs to sort of force Congress to act here. I also think going to your state is another place to look for. There have been a few state laws trying to address this. Maryland has a law trying to fix this sort of market failure for ground ambulance services. Colorado passed something recently. So there is some hope at the state level. And I think people need to keep pushing on states to fix this issue as well.
Lauren Adler is the Associate Director at the USC Brookings Schaefer Initiative for Health Policy. And David Slesky is a Professor of Economics at the University of Kansas. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.